Welcome to the Deep Dive. Okay, we're jumping right in today, straight into a really intense scenario. Picture this. EMTs, Heidi Burr and J.D. Hudson, they rush into an office building.
Okay.
They find this man, he's maybe in his 20s, seems really confused, he's pale, sweating quite a bit.
Uh-huh.
And his coworkers are there, obviously worried, saying, look, he was totally fine this morning, but then maybe 10 minutes ago, he just started acting really strangely.
Wow. Okay. Sudden change.
Yeah, exactly. So, listener, what's immediately hitting you here? That suddenness, the confusion, the sweating.
Yeah.
What kind of emergency does that suggest?
It definitely sets off alarm bells.
Right. So our deep dive today is all about cracking the code on these often really confusing acute diabetic emergencies.
Yeah.
We're going to cut through the heavy medical terms using insights from a pre-hospital care textbook, basically to give you a clear, solid understanding.
Yeah, make it accessible.
Exactly. So you walk away knowing why even a small shift in blood glucose can mess with someone's head so much.
Yeah.
And why spotting these signs, like instantly, is absolutely critical. It can literally be life or death.
It really can.
Okay, so let's unpack this starting point. We hear blood sugar all the time, right? But what is glucose really? Why is it so fundamentally important?
Well, it's the main fuel. It's the primary energy source for pretty much all your cells, and we get it mainly from carbs in our food.
Okay, fuel for cells.
Got it. But here's the really critical part, especially for emergencies. Your brain cells. They are only able to use glucose for energy. That's it.
Only glucose? Wow.
Yeah, so if there isn't enough glucose getting to them, they just can't function properly.
Wow.
That's where you see that altered mental status, the confusion, like with the guy in the office, Trent.
Ah, okay, so the confusion links directly to the brain not getting fuel.
Directly. And if that lack of glucose goes on for too long, you're looking at potential brain cell damage, even death. It's serious stuff.
So no glucose, brain shuts down.
Mm-hmm.
That's stark. But you hear about high blood sugar being bad, too. Is it one of those things where it has to be just right?
It really is. It's a delicate balance. Too little, as we said, is immediately bad for the brain. But too much glucose floating around in the blood also causes big problems.
Like what?
Well, the body tries to get rid of the excess through the kidneys, right? So it gets dumped into the urine. But glucose is kind of sticky, osmotically speaking, so it pulls a ton of water out with it.
Ah. Leading to dehydration.
Exactly. Significant dehydration. So, yeah, it's absolutely a tightrope walk. Your body needs it in a pretty narrow range to function optimally.
And keeping it in that range involves hormones, right? Like insulin.
Precisely. It's this really elegant hormonal dance. When your blood glucose level goes up, like after you eat, your pancreas releases insulin.
The famous one.
Yeah. Think of insulin as the key. It unlocks the doors on your body's cells so that glucose can get in and be used for energy. Without that key, the glucose just stays locked out, piling up in the bloodstream.
Okay, so insulin lowers blood sugar by letting it into cells. What happens when blood sugar gets too low?
That's where glucagon comes in. The pancreas releases glucagon when blood glucose dips. Its job is basically the opposite of insulin. It signals your liver to release stored glucose back into the bloodstream to bring those levels up.
So insulin pushes glucose in, glucagon pulls it out. Makes sense. But there's another player, isn't there? Epinephrine. Adrenaline.
Right. Epinephrine, your fight or flight hormone. This one gets released when blood glucose levels drop really low, like dangerously low. It's like the body hitting the panic button.
Okay. So what does epinephrine do in this case?
It actually does a couple of things. It tells the liver to dump even more glucose, and it also sort of blocks insulin from working temporarily. And here's a key point. A lot of the symptoms we associate with low blood sugar, feeling shaky, sweaty, pale, heart pounding.
Yeah, the classic signs.
A lot of that is actually caused by the epinephrine surge itself. It's your body's alarm system screaming, hey, we have an energy crisis here.
That's fascinating. So the symptoms aren't just the low sugar, but the body's reaction to it. Okay, so if this balance is so critical, what are the actual numbers? What's normal versus danger zone?
Good question. Generally, a normal fasting blood glucose level is somewhere between 70 and maybe 120 milligrams per deciliter, or MGDL. Your typical glucose meter might show readings, you know, between 80 and 120 in a healthy person.
Okay, 70 to 120.
Now, for the emergencies, We define hypoglycemia, that's low blood sugar, as a level of 70 mgDL or less, but crucially, with signs and symptoms, just the number isn't enough. The person has to be affected.
Right, like Trent being confused.
Exactly. And then hyperglycemia, or high blood sugar, we usually define that as 200 mgDL or higher, though in the emergencies we'll discuss, it's often much higher. The main takeaway is it's a tight range for healthy function.
Got it. So the number plus the symptoms tells the story. That helps frame Trent's situation.
And it leads us to diabetes itself. You know, when we say diabetes, are we talking about just one thing? Not really. Diabetes mellitus is fundamentally a problem with metabolism, how the body uses carbs, fats, proteins.
Okay.
It boils down to two main issues. Either the pancreas isn't making any or enough insulin, or the body's cells aren't responding to the insulin properly. The key isn't working in the lock, so to speak.
And that leads to that weird situation, right? Like, tons of sugar in the blood, but the cells are starving.
Exactly. It's a paradox. High blood glucose readings, but the cells, except for brain cells, which are special and don't need insulin to get glucose, are deprived. And like we said, the kidneys work overtime trying to dump the excess sugar, pulling all that water out.
Leading to the dehydration.
Right. And this whole cycle creates those classic symptoms doctors call the three Ps.
The three Ps. Okay, what are they?
Polydipsia, that's excessive thirst because you're losing so much fluid. Polyuria, excessive urination for the same reason. And polyphagia, excessive hunger, because even though there's lots of sugar around, your cells aren't getting it, so they're sending feed me signals.
First, urination, hunger. Got it. That really paints a picture. Now, understanding the types of diabetes seems key to understanding these emergencies. Let's start with type 1.
Okay, type 1. This is where the pancreas basically just stops making insulin completely. Autoimmune attack usually destroys the insulin-producing cells.
So no insulin at all?
None. These patients must take insulin, usually injections or through a pump, just to survive. It often shows up in childhood or adolescence. Peak onset is around 10 to 14 years old.
Yeah.
And typically, these individuals have a leaner build.
And they're prone to a specific emergency.
Yes. They're particularly susceptible to something called diabetic ketoacidosis, or DKA. We'll definitely get into that.
Okay. And then there's type 2 diabetes. That's the more common one, right?
Much more common, yeah. With type 2, the body either doesn't produce enough insulin to meet its needs, or, more often, the cells become resistant to the insulin that is there. The key doesn't turn smoothly in the lock anymore.
So it's not a complete lack, but more of an inefficiency.
Right. And many people with type 2 can manage it, at least initially, with things like diet changes, exercise, and oral medications that help their bodies use insulin better or make more of it. Insulin injections might be needed later on, but not always.
And who usually gets type 2?
It tends to develop later in life, often middle-aged or older, and it's strongly linked with being overweight or obese. These patients are more prone to a different kind of hyperglycemic emergency called hyperglycemic hyperosmolar nonketotic syndrome, or HHNS.
Okay, DKA for type 1, HHNS for type 2. That's a key distinction. Now, beyond these acute crises, diabetes is a long-term thing. What about managing it day-to-day?
Absolutely. It's crucial because poorly controlled diabetes over time really damages blood vessels. This significantly ramps up the risk for really serious problems. Heart attacks, strokes, kidney failure, blindness, nerve damage. It affects the whole body.
That sounds rough. Is there a way to track how well someone's managing it long term?
Yes. There's a really important blood test called the A1C, or sometimes HbA1c. It gives you a picture of the average blood glucose level over the past 2 to 3 months.
Like a long-term average instead of the snapshot.
Exactly. Think of it like a batting average versus one time at bat. A normal A1C is generally below 5.7%. Between 5.7% and 6.4% is considered pre-diabetic range. And 6.5% or higher on two separate occasions typically means a diagnosis of diabetes. It's a vital tool for tracking control.
Okay, that A1C gives the bigger picture. So let's bring it back to Trent in the office. Confused, history of diabetes, and his reading was 48 mgDL. Knowing what we know now, 48 is.
Yeah, 48 is low, way below that 70 mgDL threshold we talked about. This points directly towards hypoglycemia. That's the immediate acute emergency happening right there.
The swift threat, you called it. It makes sense. The brain isn't getting its fuel. Why does this happen so fast, typically?
It's usually down to an imbalance. The classic scenarios are someone takes their usual insulin dose, but then skips a meal or doesn't eat enough carbs.
Okay. too much insulin for the available sugar.
Right. Or they take their insulin, eat normally, but then do way more physical activity than usual, burning up glucose faster.
Like an unexpected workout.
Exactly. Or sometimes just an error taking too much insulin accidentally. Whatever the cause, the result is the same. Glucose drops and the brain reacts almost immediately.
So what are the key things to look for? We saw confusion with Trent. What else?
Altered mental status is huge. Confusion, disorientation, irritability, sometimes bizarre behavior, drowsiness, slurred speech. It can even mimic a stroke or lead to seizures or unresponsiveness.
And the physical signs?
Those are often driven by that epinephrine surge we mentioned. Pale skin, excessive sweating, we call that diaphoresis, and a rapid heartbeat, tachycardia.
Sweaty, pale, fast heart rate, confused. Okay, you mentioned something earlier, though. Hypoglycemia unawareness. That sounds worrying.
It is. Over time, especially with frequent low blood sugar episodes, some people's bodies stop giving off those clear warning signs, the shakiness, the sweating. Their glucose can drop really low without them feeling it until they're severely impaired. It's a major risk.
Wow. Okay, so if you suspect hypoglycemia and the person is conscious enough, what's the immediate treatment?
The key is, can they swallow safely? If yes, and they have altered mental status, a history of diabetes, or a confirmed low reading, like below 70, you give them oral glucose. Usually it comes in a tube of gel.
Like squeezing frosting into their mouth?
Kind of, yeah. You typically squeeze it between their cheek and gum. It gets absorbed pretty quickly right there through the mucous membranes.
What if they can't swallow or are unconscious?
Then oral glucose is out big choking risk. The priority becomes protecting their airway, giving oxygen if their levels are low, maybe assisting their breathing, checking their blood sugar if possible, and calling for advanced life support, ALS, right away.
Because ALS has other options.
Right. They can give intravenous dextrose, which is sugar directly into the vein, or sometimes injectable glucagon. There's also intranasal glucagon now.
How does the intranasal glucagon work? You mentioned it earlier.
Yeah, it's administered up the nose using a special device.
Yeah.
But remember, it doesn't give glucose. It tells the liver to release its stored glucose. So it relies on the person having glucose stores available. And it takes a bit longer to kick in, maybe, 10, 15, even 16 minutes sometimes.
So oral glucose is faster if they could take it?
Generally, yes. For someone who can swallow safely.
Okay, that covers the lows. Now let's tackle hyperglycemia, the high blood sugar side. You mentioned two big ones. DKA, mostly in type 1, and HHNS, mostly in type 2. Let's start with DKA diabetic ketoacidosis.
Right. DKA happens when there's a severe lack of insulin, typically in type 1 diabetes. Blood sugar gets really high, often over 350 mg/dL, sometimes much higher.
And without insulin.
The cells are starving, even with all that sugar around. So the body gets desperate and starts burning fat for energy at a very high rate.
Okay, burning fat seems okay.
Normally, yes, but when it happens this fast and without insulin's regulation, the process produces acidic byproducts called ketones. These ketones build up in the blood, making it dangerously acidic. That's the ketoacidosis part.
Ah, okay. Acid in the blood. What usually triggers DKA?
Often it's an infection. The body's stress response increases glucose and insulin needs. Or maybe missing insulin doses, problems with an insulin pump, certain medications, major physical stress like surgery or trauma, or even just eating way more carbs than usual without adjusting insulin.
So the body gets overwhelmed. What does DKA look like? Does it come on suddenly like hypoglycemia?
No, that's a key difference. DKA usually develops much more slowly, often over hours to days. You'll see signs of severe dehydration from all that sugar pulling water out, the polydipsia thirst, polyuria, urination, maybe poor skin turgor, a fast heart rate.
Okay, dehydration. What about the acid?
The acid buildup causes nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, maybe muscle cramps because the electrolytes get out of whack.
Okay.
But the really classic telltale signs are a sweet, fruity odor on the breath, that's the ketones being exhaled, and a specific breathing pattern called Kussmaul respirations.
Kussmaul? What's that?
It's very deep, rapid breathing. It's the body's attempt to blow off carbon dioxide, which is acidic, to try and counteract the metabolic acidosis from the ketones. It looks like air hunger.
Deep, fast breathing and fruity breath.
Yeah.
Got it. What's the emergency care? Can EMTs fix this?
Not directly fix it, no. These patients need insulin and IV fluids, which requires ALS or hospital care. So pre-hospital care is supportive. Manage the airway, give oxygen if needed, assist breathing if it's poor, check the blood glucose. And importantly, if you're ever unsure if it's hypo or hyperglycemia and the patient can swallow.
Give the glucose.
Yes. The risk of not treating potentially deadly hypoglycemia outweighs the small harm of giving a bit more sugar to someone already very high. Always follow local protocols and contact medical direction, of course.
Better safe than sorry with hypoglycemia. Okay, now the other high sugar state, HHNS, hyperglycemic, hyperosmolar, non-ketotic syndrome, mostly type 2, you said.
Right. And the blood sugar levels here can be absolutely astronomical, often 600 to 1200 mgdl, sometimes even higher.
Whoa, that's incredibly high. What's happening differently than a DKA?
The key difference is in the name, non-ketotic. In HHNS, there's usually just enough background insulin activity to prevent the body from switching over to massive fat burning. So you don't get that significant buildup of ketones and the resulting acidosis.
Okay, no ketones, no fruity breath, no Kussmaul breathing.
Exactly. But the hyperosmolar part is the killer here. With those incredibly high glucose levels, the kidneys are dumping sugar like crazy and pulling unbelievable amounts of water out with it. The blood becomes super concentrated, like syrup that's hyperosmolar.
So the main danger is extreme dehydration.
Extreme, life-threatening dehydration and electrolyte imbalances. HHNS actually has a very high mortality rate, often higher than DKA, because the dehydration can be so profound and it often affects older patients with other health issues.
So what are the signs then, if not the DKA classics?
You'll see signs of severe dehydration, extreme thirst, dry mouth, poor skin turgor, maybe fever, rapid heart rate, low blood pressure.
Mm.
Neurologically, they'll likely have altered mental status, confusion, drowsiness, potentially seizures or coma, largely due to the dehydration and the hyperosmolarity affecting the brain.
But no fruity breath or Kussmaul breathing.
Correct. That's the key differentiator from DKA. Emergency care is similar. Supportive measures, check blood glucose, protect the airway, oxygen, transport, and definitely get ALS involved for aggressive fluid resuscitation and eventual insulin therapy in the hospital. Mm. And again, if unsure and they can swallow, give oral glucose.
Okay, so let's quickly compare these three side by side. Hypoglycemia, DKA, HHNS. What are the absolute must-know differences in an emergency?
This is super important for quick recognition. So, onset. Hypoglycemia is sudden, minutes. DKA and HHNS are slow, hours to days.
Got it. Fast versus slow.
Heart rate, often fast, tachycardia in all three, maybe less so initially in hypoglycemia. Blood pressure. Hypo tends to be normal or high. DKA, HHNS tend to be low due to dehydration.
Okay, BP is a clue.
Respirations. This is big. DKA has those deep, rapid, Kussmaul breaths. Hypo and HHNS are usually normal or maybe shallow if the patient is very sick.
The breathing pattern. Check.
Breath odor. Sweet and fruity only in DKA. Absent in hypo and HHNS. Mental status. Hypo can cause really bizarre, agitated or aggressive behavior or unresponsiveness. DKA is more confusion progressing to coma late. HHNS is often marked confusion, seizures possible.
Okay, different mental states.
Thirst. Intense in DKA and HHNS, usually absent in hypoglycemia. Blood glucose. Hypo is low, 70. DKA is high, 250, often 350 plus. HHNS is extremely high, 600, often much more.
And the immediate need.
Hypoglycemia needs glucose. DKA and HHNS need insulin and fluids, which means ALS and hospital care. Knowing these differences helps you figure out what's likely going on and what needs to happen next.
That's a fantastic breakdown. So when you arrive on scene, someone's got altered mental status, potentially diabetic.
Sure.
How do you start putting the pieces together? What are you looking for?
Scene clues are big. Look for medical alert jewelry necklaces, bracelets, maybe a tattoo indicating diabetes. Is there an insulin pump visible? Insulin pens or vials lying around? A glucose meter?
Obvious signs. What about questions?
Your sample history is key, specifically for diabetes. Did they take their medication today? Did they take their insulin? When? How much? Did they eat their meals as usual? Have they vomited? Did they do any unusual exercise? These answers can give you huge clues about whether it's likely hypo or hyperglycemia.
So, connecting their actions to their current state, are there any tricky situations to be aware of?
Definitely. As we touched on, sometimes hypoglycemia, especially in older adults, can look exactly like a stroke, one-sided weakness, facial droop, slurred speech. Always check a blood sugar in suspected stroke patients if you can.
Good tip. Check the sugar. Anything else?
Yeah, certain medications can mask symptoms. Beta blockers, for example, which lots of people take for high blood pressure or heart conditions, can blunt some of those epinephrine-driven warning signs of hypoglycemia, like the fast heart rate or shakiness. Makes it harder to spot.
So you might not see the classic signs even if their sugar is low.
Oh.
Okay, so pulling it all together, what's the basic emergency care approach regardless of the specific cause if someone has altered mental status?
Always start with the ABCs: airway, breathing, circulation. Make sure their airway is open. Give oxygen if their SpO2 is below 94%. If their breathing is too slow or shallow, you need to breathe for them with the bag valve mask.
Basics first. Always.
Always. Then, if you suspect hypoglycemia based on history or signs, and you can check a blood glucose level and it's low, like 70, and they can swallow safely.
Give the oral glucose.
Give the oral glucose.
And after you give it.
Just wait.
You reassess constantly. Is their mental status improving? Are they becoming more alert? Remember, it might take up to 20 minutes to see a significant change. Keep monitoring their airway, breathing, and circulation. If they don't improve,
then maybe it wasn't just low sugar or something else is going on too.
Exactly. You have to consider other causes of altered mental status and keep communicating with medical direction.
Okay. So let's bring it home with Trent one last time. Confused, pale, sweaty, history of diabetes, BGL of 48. EMTs gave him oral glucose. What was the outcome? Well, they followed the hypoglycemia protocol perfectly. They gave the glucose, continued to monitor him closely on the way to the hospital, managed his airway, and importantly, they started to see his mental status improve during transport. He became a bit more oriented.
So it worked.
It did. It shows how recognizing those specific signs of hypoglycemia and giving the right treatment glucose can have a rapid positive impact. Quick action based on good assessment.
That really highlights the importance of everything we've discussed. So let's wrap up the key takeaways for everyone listening. First, diabetes is basically a problem managing blood glucose.
That's the core issue.
Second, hypoglycemia, low blood sugar, often hits fast, looks like confusion, sweating, maybe weird behavior, and needs glucose now.
Get them sugar safely.
Third, hyperglycemia, high blood sugar, is slower. It can lead to DKA, mostly in type 1s, with that acid buildup, fruity breath, and Kussmaul breathing. Or it can lead to HHNS, mostly in type 2s, causing extreme dehydration without the ketones.
Two different paths for high sugar, both dangerous.
And finally, recognizing these differences through careful assessment, looking at onset, breathing, breath, skin, and getting that blood sugar reading, if possible, is absolutely vital for providing the right supportive care and getting the patient the help they need, whether it's glucose or insulin. You now have a much deeper understanding of these critical situations.
Definitely. And maybe one final thought to leave you with. We've focused a lot on these acute dramatic emergencies, the moments where quick action is obviously life-saving.
Right, the crises.
But step back and consider this. Diabetes, for most people living with it, isn't about these crises. It's about the day-in, day-out management, the constant vigilance, the food choices, the medication timing, the blood sugar checks. While understanding these emergencies is crucial, how much does it underscore the profound importance of that daily effort to prevent them from ever happening? How does knowing how bad things can get highlight the silent, persistent, often invisible battle that individuals with diabetes fight every single day just to stay balanced and healthy?